presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denijir Dilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas, con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
And coming up next, it's the 11-3, that's November 3rd edition of Bathrob's Pierre's Broadsides. Going to have interviews with Keith McHenry, folks at the Benchlands, before it was completely dumped, swept, and trashified. And a few other goodies, plus we have an interview with Aaron Mate's university guest on the Ukraine. He'll be identifying himself and talking towards the end of this show. A lot of this I'm putting on, well, for two reasons. One, I think it's an important issue. And second, on Thursdays, I'm finding I have less and less time to do this show. So hopefully I'm putting in something that's worth your hearing. And you can let me know what you think of that. But let's get on with it.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
Okay, well, it's the 27th of October. It's about 20 to 2. I'm talking with
Barefoot Brad.
And Barefoot Brad, the last time we talked was God knows when, but do you remember where we met?
I believe we met right here.
Town Clock.
I believe so, yes.
Was One Ton Dave around?
One Ton Dave was here, and Shoeless Joe, Joe Biff's, what was Joe's nickname?
I forget. Jetlag Joe.
Jetlag Joe, yeah, and also the guy with the glasses.
Red Top Robert.
Red Top Robert, I love Red Top Robert. He was so cool. Yeah, those guys were all here. One Ton Jacob. That was during the Iranian. That was during the
Persian Gulf War.
Persian Gulf, 1981. I don't know when it was.
1991.
Yeah, some way the heck back when.
And why were you here? What was that about? If you remember.
Well, we just did a sit-in here at the Town Clock. We all got tickets, and I ended up having to do community service at the high school for a week for mine. I had to be a janitor there. That was kind of fun. I got so many tickets, I couldn't believe I earned a week of community service, but yeah.
How did the police treat you?
They're all right. Sometimes they're nimnolds, you know. Corbis and Winston used to give me a lot of shit, especially Officer Winston. He was kind of a dick, but they were all right.
And actually, this sit-in or sleep-out that Barefoot Brad mentioned, I think it was mentioned because he... I didn't wear shoes. It was another fellow called Shoeless Joe. These were activists who originally were protesting the Iraqi war, who, after the police became relatively violent and abusive, stealing their property, stealing their survival gear, they decided to stay on and continued their protests for several months at the Town Clock. This was before it was a so-called park. It was turned into a park, actually, as a part of the attempt to get rid of the protesters rather than address the real issues that they were concerned about, police violence against the homeless. The original protests about the war and the Persian Gulf, Bush's war, the elder Bush, as I said, had sort of transmogrified into something else based on how the police were treating peaceful homeless protesters. And some homeless people who joined them in order to be protected at night, although they ended up being targeted more than protected.
The in and out, you know, getting a ticket's better than going to jail and then having to deal with it that way. So you get a ticket, you go to court, they give you community service, you pay the, what, $25 or whatever it was back then, and they send you to community service. So I did a week at the Santa Cruz High School, and I had to do a couple days at the Salvation Army afterwards. And that was it. That was my That was my perdition for standing against the town clock in a massive protest.
What was the issue that you were at the town clock for?
I believe we were protesting Reagan's involvement in the second Iranian war or something. I forget what it was.
That would be Bush's involvement.
Bush's involvement, yeah.
The older Bush.
Mm-hmm. CIA and shit like that.
Now, was the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz involved at all?
Yeah, we were getting tickets because we were asleep. We were here at the town clock and we weren't supposed to be spending the night here. And even across the street at Scribner's Park, we were getting tickets for sleeping. I think that's where they were generating all the tickets from, was a sleeping ban. It's not as bad anymore. You can actually see people sleeping on the sidewalks now. So they've won a little bit of a victory from it.
Or else people have gotten so desperate they're just spilling out there. You mentioned you had gotten housing and you recently lost it.
Yeah, I got evicted. I had a real dick for a neighbor, and I think he called the cops on me a couple times, but he was Aryan Nation, so I didn't give a fuck. He's a real prick. And that might have led to me getting evicted, but I think my landlord just wanted somebody that had a car and was a breadwinner. So she evicted me after 8 years. It was fun while it lasted.
How does it differ from now? You mentioned there are more people on the streets. You say there's more leniency, seemingly, or maybe they're just don't have the manpower to, you know, go after everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not afraid when I camp. I'm not afraid that I'm going to get a ticket now. I think it's non-existent, which is good. So somehow or other, the sleeping thing is passed into moral, Betty Bye or whatever. We don't see very often. We don't see too much of a...
They put the sleeping ban to bed, did they?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, how do you see it? You're still active with it. What do you think?
Well, they just demolished most of the Benchlands campground, as you probably know. And I'm afraid that... And they have some people, they have these excuses, or you might say these actual so-called alternatives for people to go to into programs like the Armory... The Overlook, it's called, and then there's 1220 River, and then there's the Pallets out at 115 Coral Street.
Now, where are people staying when they're still outdoors? Do you know of any camping areas where people are still camping in groups anywhere around here at all?
It's still illegal everywhere in Santa Cruz to do that, but people are doing it anyway because they have to. I mean...
No alternative, just like everywhere else in California. Where else can you go, you know? I heard that they made camping illegal in downtown Portland the other day. That's what I heard.
I think I read something about that. I'm not entirely sure. But I know that what they want to do is force you to sign up for a program, use the court system to either you have to classify yourself as disabled, mentally ill, a drug abuser, antisocial, I don't know, whatever kind of, you know, label.
I like the term transient. That was always my favorite. I'm transient.
Undesirable transient element.
Okay, I'll go with that one. I'll deal with that, yeah.
You're a ute, man.
I'm still youthful, yeah, but I'm not a youth anymore,
Not a youth, but a ute, U-G-E. Undesirable transient element.
Oh, a ute, yeah. Hey, I'm an
Indian.
That's
what they called people in the 70s here.
Ute, undesirable transient entity?
Element.
Element, okay, good. I'm a ute.
You aren't that transient. You're here. You've been here for years.
I had a mattress and a box spring, and I wanted to give it to the homeless after they cleared the Benchlands, but I had to know where they might be setting up a camp someplace outdoors, and I would drive it there. But I couldn't find out from anybody. I asked and asked and asked, and nobody seemed to know, so we made a dump run, and I took it to the dump. Because now, when I was working for Furniture for Families, it cost money to go to the dump with your mattresses. Now you can take them for free. So we actually made a dump run, tossed some stuff, and actually the mattress was free to dump, and it didn't have to pay for it. So I was stoked on that. So that was about beginning of the month, I think.
Yes. You're outside now.
Oh, yeah. I'm back where I used to be in Aptos most of the time. And also up on the hill every now and then, up on whatever.
Sheriffs aren't hassling you.
No. You know, they never did in Aptos. Once I was camping there years and years ago, and I was sleeping on the clover leaf, and it was like wooded and everything. There was a lot of wooded area there. I'd go at night, and I'd chop off things that would get in my way so I had a good path in the dark to camp. And I was there sleeping near the hedge and near a big plant and everything. You couldn't see me. And all of a sudden, there's this flashlight in my eye at 1:30 in the morning. And I go, oh, fuck, It's got to be a cop or something. And the guy takes one look at me, and he shouts over to the other guy over by the bridge next to Highway 1. Oh, this isn't him. This is just some transit guy sleeping. Never mind. And they took off. And
How long ago?
Oh, that was before I got housed. So that was back in early 2000s sometimes, 2006 maybe. It's kind of funny. So I was there forever and ever and ever. And one time, I get stopped on the bench in the morning, and a cop go, "What? The reason I stopped you? Look like somebody that something's happening in Cabrillo. We thought it might be you. Where'd you spend the night last night?" And I didn't know what to say. And I, "Oh, were you camping? That's okay." And then he passed it up, and I thought, "Oh, good. They don't mind you camping down there." So every now and then, you know, people would sleep in the parking lot at the Resurrection Church across the way, and I see homeless people every now and then there now. So I'm still in the same general area. I'm just on the other side of the street. I was in the cloverleaf, and they cleared it all up. So I'm on the other side in the wilderness where the trees are still. Same place I always was for years and years and years and years and years.
Were you around when Camp Paradise 20 years ago was doing its thing with Larry Templeton? And I don't know if you remember that. It was right along Highway 1.
That area over there, past the shopping center, right in Highway 1?
That would be Ross Camp. Yeah, but it's over on the other side of the highway.
By Denny's. You mean over on the Denny's side?
Yeah.
I think I remember hearing about that. Yeah, I was never over there, but I remember hearing about it. Yeah.
91, in 2001, there was a campground there. Speaking of which, here come our friends of the Santa Cruz Police.
So. Yeah, you go on that side, you walk on that side, and then you walk along the freeway in the ditch, right? That area. On this side of the...
You walk to the end of Felker Street. You know, Denny's, and you walk all the way to the end of the dead ends in the river.
Yeah.
Then you walk down under the freeway, and if you kept walking, that was Camp Paradise.
Oh. You mean under the freyway?
Under the freeway, and then beyond under the freeway.
Oh, towards where the red barn places are, that area.
Across from the cemetery and across from the tannery, if you know where the tannery
is. Yeah, the tannery's where all the red house and the red barn places are and shit, right there, right?
I don't know what color they are,
okay,
but...
You go under Highway 1 and that extended.
Yes.
That. I've seen, yeah, I remember guys. There was some of the guys who were sub Rosa that tore up the mall that time. Some of the guys stayed there that were with that. You remember that they all wore masks and they tore up the mall?
I remember there was a thing in 2010, there was an incident here.
Yeah, they broke a bunch of windows. That was it.
Yeah.
That was it. Yeah, those guys stayed in those trees past the freeway. That
you usually camp alone or in company?
I camp alone, yeah. I always have.
With an animal, with a companion of any kind?
No, just my psychic self.
You're a psychic self, yeah.
No, I'm kidding, yeah, I don't know. If I had a dog or something, I would camp with a dog, but I don't. Because I get on the bus in the morning. When I first started going there in the 90s, I felt guilty. I thought, fuck, I've got a free camp. I take the bus every morning, so I walked the camp for a whole month, 8 miles out and 8 miles in. And I walked the whole month down to with I had a duffel bag then. I remember carrying a duffel bag, not a backpack. So I two-strap double bag.
You're gonna punish yourself.
Oh, I did for a month just to make sure I earned. I don't know how long I was going to have to be staying there. Obviously, quite a long time. So I thought I'll pay for it first off, and that'll endear me to whatever psychic thing they were saying. You're a lazy bum. Oh, you're not too lazy. You walk, you know. Whatever it was, there's always an extra you can smooth over. So I did.
Yeah.
And I walked the whole way downtown, 8 miles, downtown, back to camp every night for a month. And that was it. After that, I said, fuck it. I ruined it. I'm going to take the bus for the rest of my life down to the... So I take the bus at 11 at night with all the Mexican guys coming from the restaurants and stuff. We'd all hang out in the bus, and they'd go to Watsonville, and I'd go to Aptos. And then that was back then, before I got... Then I went back down to Laguna Beach, and I got called up with my Section 8 came through. And I had to come up in, like, the end of 2011, beginning of 2012, and start signing up for Section 8. And it took till the end of 2013 for that to come through, and then I got a place.
And you've been there for 8 years, and then...
Till August, yeah. I got out August 8th. I got evicted. So I'm still in. I have to go see a lawyer to try to get my deposit back from him if I can. And I'm still trying to find another place to live.
You have a phone?
Yep.
If you want, give me your number, and I may get in touch with you to get updates if you feel like it.
Okay. All right, we'll do that.
Anything you want to add before I sign off?
I think maybe if it has something to do with all the drugs that are around, I like the fact that they've lightened up on marijuana and they're legalizing it. I know Joe Biden just let a lot of people out of prison for marijuana offenses about a week ago also.
Actually, what he did was he declared...
he would strike their records, but nobody got out of prison.
Oh, but they got the records struck.
That's it. I mean, in other words, there are plenty of people in jail in the federal government for other crimes, some of them hard drugs, some of them selling marijuana. Nobody got out for that. But he wanted to do something. This is my analysis. Yeah. He wanted to do his thing for the election because he wants to keep a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives.
A little late for that.
Yeah, it's a little late for that. It's a little.
He's so unprofessional. One time when he was running for president in this last election, his advertisement went like this. He goes, "Hi, this is Joe." And then he carried on from there, and I go, "What?
He's a regular Joe."
He's a regular joke off, is what he is. You can't do that. You have to say, "This is Joe Biden. I'm running for president." You have to do that. It's part of the parliamentary crap that you have to go through. You couldn't do that. You could get away with that in high school, and still they'd complain about it if you said, "Hi, I'm Bill. You know me. You all know me. I'm senior class president. I'm running for fucking this and that treasurer," whatever. You know, I mean, the fact that he used his first name shows his lack of. It's like walking on stage with pajamas on, no tuxedo, no tie. Probably hadn't even brushed his teeth and hasn't wiped his butt. He's probably has toilet paper drilling from his rear end, and he's pulling a Joe Biden like he always does.
I don't mind his doing that. What I mind is the people he's fronting for is what bothers me. I mean, it's, you know, this wealth situation gets worse and worse, poorer, more and more poor people, and it's.
But he just told the Saudis off last week, and they go, "Hey, we're a nation of martyrdom and jihad. We don't like being threatened." This is Joe Biden. Put his foot in his mouth in front of those guys.
He hasn't stopped arming them, so they're going after Yemen still.
Yeah, but he was really rude to him in public about the oil and everything like that. You got to give those guys credit. They're clean. They're like Ringo's. They're like Ringo's grandfather. They're clean.
They're clean old man.
They're clean old man. Yeah. Well, he's clean old man.
Brad, let me. You don't mind if I put this on the net to let people know that you're still alive and cranky.
Yeah, please tell us.
Cranky. You're not cranky at all, actually. And you're not even barefoot anymore. Times have changed, Brad.
You know what? I had glass in my feet, and the whole time I was barefoot in, when was it? 94. 94, I got the first piece out of my heel. He took it out there. I heard a Billy Joel lyric as soon as it came out of my foot. I heard a Billy Joel lyric. He was probably glad that the glass was out of there. For some reason, we're probably standing in the thing, and this piece of glass, I don't know why I heard, but I heard a Billy Joel lyric as soon as he pulled the glass out of my heel. And then about a year later, I got the one in this foot out. I had a little sliver in the ball of my foot.
And you've been walking around all these years with glass in your feet?
I had for about 12 years, from about 82 to 94, yeah.
Was it very painful for you?
One of my right foot was hella painful, man. It was like, it was a big chunk, and it was in my right heel, and so I'd step on it, and yank! And when I'd be barefoot, I'd hit something down there, like a rock, and I'd step right on it, and I'd, it would hurt really bad, because I'd land right on the sore spot. And then I would sleep in Laguna Beach, and it started throbbing at 4 in the morning, really throbbing in pain. Like, I'd wake up, and I was scared I was going to die. Nobody would remove it. I went to doctors. Oh, we don't want to do it. There's, you know.
How did you finally get it out?
I had the skin doctor. I had these, I had moles, you know.
Hey, have some food, man. I'm not going to finish this.
Oh, dude, are you kidding me? I'm lucky I finished what I finished. I ate a lot of big potatoes. I had mole right here, and I had biopsies right here, and I was going to a skin doctor right next to St. Jude and Fullerton. St. Jude Hospital was one right off, you know, just Dumb Short Irving's, you know, a laser dermatology center right next to St. Jude. So I went there one day and I go, "Hey, your needles don't hurt." You know, he puts a needle on before he cuts it out and you never feel it. And I go, "Would you go ahead and, that thing right there is a piece of glass, would you give me the honors and take that out?"
And he did.
And he was so cool. And he did, and he took it out, and I'll be damned. He said, "Just say it's a bone spur, we're good." You know, because he had to write it in his report or something like that for Medicare to cover it. And so I went back to Laguna Beach, and my foot was better.
I'm going to leave it there because I got someone waiting. But again, we've been talking with
Barefoot Brad once again. Good to see you again, Robert.
Time was when a man could live alone. Man was free to roam over land that wasn't known. Peaceful years would flow, he could watch his children grow. But it was a long time ago. Time was when a man could have his land. He could farm it with his hands, he was free to make a stand. He could live a life of toil with his future in the soil. But it was a long time ago. Time was when troubles were few, when there weren't so many people to tell you what to do. Time was when a man could have his pride, when time was on his side and there was no need to hide. The world was far away, there was truth in every day. But it was a long time ago. Time was when troubles were few, when there weren't so many people to tell you what to do. Time was when a man could have his pride, when time was on his side and there was no need to hide. The world was far away, there was truth in every day. But it was a long time ago. It was a long time ago.
And that was Time Was by Phil Oakes from the album On My Way, which is a kind of a combination of his demos. So now it's time to go to the last days of the San Lorenzo survival encampment in the Benchlands, the Phase 8 demolition, which happened on the 1st of November. Again, I remind you, without adequate shelter, even for the people who they were evicting, most of the people, they claimed that there was a very limited number of people that were being evicted. I think the numbers were far undercounted. So if you want to take it from Larry Imwali, who calls himself, I guess the city also calls him this, Santa Cruz's homelessness response manager, he cites, well, this is Jessica York's article in the Sentinel Online, which appeared, I guess, yesterday, maybe, and it's in today's edition. He says that 135 people, quote, well, he says specifically, we have the people who are up at the Armory right now, the 135 people that are now in better shelter conditions, and it's sort of one step toward more stable permanent housing. This, of course, is both misleading and false, in my view. It's, at least in part, both of those things. It's misleading because it talks about the 135 people now in better shelter conditions, which is true, probably, in some respects, than in the Benchlands, where the city intentionally, or through neglect, made it a miserable place to be and then started shoveling people in at a huge rate, claiming it was a sanctioned campground, as so it was their excuse to start removing people from all the other campgrounds throughout the city, concentrating them there, and then crushing people, crunching people, putting them in a vice, in essence, as they continue to shut down phase after phase of the Benchlands, giving them no alternatives to leave except for the Armory and the Overlook outdoor encampment, which, of course, is a violation of the court's Martin versus Boise ruling. But more important, perhaps, to folks who are used to living outdoors, it was a very confined area, distant from community resources, community meeting places, heavily controlled, behind fences, not allowing visitors, requiring you to sign in and sign out, having curfews and so forth. And so in a way, Imwali set up a situation, or perhaps through the dictates of his boss, Matt Heffaker, a situation that he knew people would be rejecting. And in rejecting it, they would allow there to be some vacancies so that he could claim that there was always options if only people wanted to accept what some called prison-like conditions. Now, of course, what folks in the Benchlands and the community needed to do was to get together, as they had done 2 years before, when a similar move by former city manager Martine Bernal and his police chief Andy Mills had moved on the encampment that was sitting around the duck pond and the upper area of the San Lorenzo Park, as well as the benchlands. And the community came together, and as well as the Union of the Homeless, and they got a temporary restraining order, as well as actually standing off the police by being there physically. That didn't happen this year, perhaps because the city adopted a canny, sly strategy of slicing off the bench lands one segment by one segment and allowing people this escape hatch of going into the other areas that are as yet untaken. But, of course, every one of the areas got eventually demolished, and that's what happened on this day to the 8th area. I don't have a lot of audio, but I have some. I'm going to play it now.
So it's a, I guess, a light rain happening here at the Phase 8 demolition. I'm on the path right above the last remains of the benchlands. I'm counting 10, 15, 20, 25. I'd say maybe 40 or 50 people, both in the campground, coming up, removing small pieces of property, guitars, with stuff being left along the path here, presumably in transit to somewhere else.
And what Jessica York's story that I was quoting Imwale from says is that there were 24 people still living in the San Lorenzo Park benchlands in the week leading into the morning's final closure, and that only 10 people were moved into the managed city overlook encampment in De La Vega Park. There was at least three or four times that number of people that I saw there. Well, no, two or three times that number. And the second part of the claim that there was this great help, that essentially people got into the armory as a path toward more stable, permanent housing, it simply generally isn't true that the people get put into these shelters find permanent housing. They just don't, generally. Mainly because the housing doesn't exist, and it's simply a notion that in the future it will exist. And also we want to have a place to put people so we can drive them out of public places and reassure the nervous residents who don't somehow think all homeless people are threats to their safety and that of their children, when there's been no such evidence that this really is true. But anyway, here's more of what I heard and saw.
There are two SCPD vehicles. There's a smiling Carter Jones over there. Hi.
And Carter Jones, in case I don't mention it, is sort of the go-to guy who is leading this destruction of hundreds of people's homes, survival gear, and property, and doing so with a grin on his face and a song in his heart, it seems like, occasionally helping people to carry stuff out, but mostly keeping them out when they try to come back and carry off more stuff, saying, oh, you had a week to take it all away. But, of course, the only place they could legally take it was, and they couldn't take much of it, would be up to the armory under the conditions mentioned before that were unacceptable to the majority of people there.
Jones, go somewhere else.
Jones.
Move on. Move on. You're making a democracy of you.
Not really.
That's always good.
Yeah, I think so.
And actually, Jessica York begins her article by describing this as a buzz with activity. Actually, it was a frantic, chaotic scene where people were desperately trying to haul out property before it was taken and destroyed and thrust into a dumpster by police. And there isn't any real indication of that in this story. That's one of the reasons I get so pissed with Jessica's writing, because she's a scribe for the establishment, which I shouldn't find any surprise or shock at discovering.
So it's now about 5 to 9. We were hearing the police car say 15 minutes, and that was 10 minutes ago, or that's what I gather. And I'm talking with
Sea Otter.
Sea Otter, you're here with Laura to kind of witness what's going on. Disgraceful demolition of the survival encampment. And you're also going to be... you're one of the speakers, or you're just one of the originator of the free guide?
A co-author, along with Meredy Wells of Mariposa. We both came up with the free guide about 10 years ago to help people navigate free stuff in Santa Cruz.
Which I've seen, and actually it was one of the few real free guides. How does that compare with Morrison's free guide, or are you working with him now?
Morrison's free guide leaves out a lot of information.
And does it give a lot of false hopes, is my question.
Yes, it does.
How so?
There's changes that they don't know about. Like the situation at St. Francis Catholic Kitchen.
What should they know about that they don't know?
They don't have food not bombs listed. And Janus is not a free program.
What is the requirement to get into Janus?
You have to have income.
What kind of income?
More than $500 a month.
Now, Janus, as you may know, if you're an old-timer here, is a drug treatment program.
To participate in...
How long will that get you in for?
A month. A month at a time. Yeah.
$500 a month.
It's another program that only the rich can afford. You know,
relatively rich anyway.
Yeah, a person on the street won't be able to afford Janus, even after a court order.
So what do the people do for when they get a court order?
Skip it.
So if they're court ordered into a program, do they go back to jail? Do they hide out?
Usually for not following the court order.
Even though if the court knows they have no money?
Yeah. It's a corrupt system. Yeah.
I knew that, I think, somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
Well, I see the cops and the sheriffs are putting up.
Why is the sheriff?
I don't know. I'm assuming they're backup or something in case people decide to say fuck off and go away, which, of course, would be nice if people got together to do it if they wanted to. But would I risk all my property and my freedom? I don't know. You know, good question. There's been a slight lessening in the number of tents here, but most of the tents are still up, and I don't know. Are you a good judge, Sea Otter, of how usable a tent is? I mean, if they had time to remove these tents in an orderly way, they'll claim. Of course, the police will claim that they have given them a week.
But a lot of the easy up and large tents are made out of polyester. Yeah. And polyester will not hold up in direct sunlight for very long. The particles in the material start disintegrating because they don't have any UV protection in clothing. So the polyester tents tend to start ripping out after 6 months of use.
But if these have been used only for a short period of time, they could still be salvaged for a while.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking, if the police actually gave these folks time, instead of destroying this property, which is what they did to all the other left behind or property that was remaining when they forced everybody out, It could be used, right?
Yeah, exactly. It could be reused, yeah.
Now, are you and Laura here to video what's going on, too? Or?
Yeah, the problem is we can't take pictures of video with anybody in it.
Why not?
Courts don't like
screw the courts. Show the public. The courts are never going to see this shit anyway, probably. I mean, Laura's got a fixation on the courts, I'm afraid, in my view. But you know, I'd like to see that happen. But yeah, I mean, I'd say take video as much as you can if she's up for it. I mean, I don't have video.
I'm taking certain still shots.
Right. I mean, is that you want to have the public see what's being destroyed? That's and the kind of misery that's being imposed by this crew of police officers.
Lawful police.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they're lawful or unlawful, but they're certainly well, they're unconstitutional. That's for damn sure. People are
right. You know, the city should lose their city charter on this. And have something like Watsonville as the county seat, and no longer Santa Cruz.
I don't know if that would make much difference. I don't know how Watsonville treats homeless people. Have you got any idea?
Watsonville is a little better than Santa Cruz in treating the homeless.
Get put on the list.
And
get put on the list. Get put on the list because I never know what he's going to do.
This woman is walking around looking for Jeremy to get signed up. Yeah. Yeah, Jeremy will show up probably in an hour or something. And we're talking about, in case I don't mention it, Jeremy Leonard, who's the paid city guy who is supposed to be hooking people up with a so-called pathway to housing or emergency shelter or other alternatives to the what to do when the bulldozer comes for you. Have you talked to Jeremy? Or?
No, I don't know who he is.
He's a tall guy with blonde hair who isn't here yet, as far as I can see.
When does he show up?
Well, who knows? Last time he showed up an hour late, so I don't know.
Yeah, well...
Hello. It's 10 after 9. No police warnings yet, which is good. Some of the tents are collapsed, carried away, but I'm still counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 15, 20 or 25 tents still here. Hey, man, how's it going?
Okay. Better for me than you, folks.
That's for damn sure. And the Sentinel is here with a photographer taking pictures. Morning, Ron, again. And again, both sides of the trail are filling up with possessions that people are salvaging in anticipation of a police blockade of the area. Including solar panels, couches, chairs, buckets of goods, trailers, dogs, you name it. About 9:15 or so, a little earlier, it looks like the police are moving from their vehicles, which are parked on the grass between the duck pond and the children's playground. Hey there, you poot. Hello, you doggy. And they're moving into the benchland and putting on their gloves. My goodness, watch out.
Yeah.
Some folks still have Halloween masks or costumes on, very few, of course. And the bulldozer is starting to crunch property at the very end of the encampment. There's yellow tape up. You can hear the beeping of the bulldozer. Carter Jones, the demolition boss of the police department, is down there supervising or walking around in an authoritative manner. Some of his underlings are there as well. The rain is beginning again. It's kind of been on and off, but it's
It's pretty, it has been pretty constant for the last half hour. Now it seems to be a little heavier. Some folks have umbrellas. I don't, but no problem. Folks are coming through and apologizing for trying to get through a crowded pathway.
Well, you got to take your stuff out, right? You're busy.
No, I need one. I have everything.
What's your name, and if you want to say?
Miguel Portillo.
Miguel, I think we may have talked before. I don't know. Have we spoken before?
Yeah, we've spoken before.
How has the last week been for you?
What do you say?
How has the last week here in the camp been?
Everything is terrible, you know, because we have to move it, you know, and I don't know what they're doing with the money I give you for the city. Suppose they give you $21 million for the homeless people, and they wanna doing expense and business for the other people, but they don't use money for the homeless people. The most people they don't know, but I know about this one, you know. This is only game for them, you know, because they make money for that one, you know. The city, you know, is only, I have to tell you, this big business for the city, you know, it's why they move people somewhere. After that, they go put tickets for the people, more money, they want more money, you know.
Stupid shit, in other words, because people can't pay those tickets anyway.
Excuse me?
They cannot pay the tickets. No puede pagar. Ellos no pueden pagar los the tickets. No tengo. Ellos no tienen dinero, ¿verdad?
Yeah. If we don't have money, we can pay the ticket. But this is what they doing. Give you tickets. I got a ticket for camping. You know. I got a ticket. You know. I don't know. They discount my social security because you know I receive my social security.
Where are you going to go now? Do you know?
Huh?
Where do you intend to go with your stuff? If you any thought?
I don't know. I move now to the bridge, and maybe I move from here, Santa Cruz, because Santa Cruz the rent is the problem.
I remember you told me before.
Yeah, the rent, you know, but they protection the rich people, you know, the people rent rooms, the people have building houses, but not for the poor people. I receive $1,200 a monthly is what the room.
And you can't afford it anyway.
You know, one room costs maybe more than that one, you know.
And again, we've been talking with?
Excuse me?
Miguel, you are, what's your name? Say it again.
Miguel Portillo. I am from Guatemala.
I remember. Thank you, Miguel.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
So Officer Carr is telling someone in a tent he has to move. And I'm not sure what the guy in the tent is saying. Thank you, Miguel. Thank you for talking to me on a bad day, right? So the police are not threatening arrest yet, but they are terrorizing people into moving with in the most courteous possible manner, of course. Camper, our resident here, comes up saying that He tried to get a shelter, but was told last week he didn't have any place, right?
Yeah.
That tall guy, Jeremy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, man. There is a sort of a small section of the campground now that has been taped off with yellow do not cross tape, and it is being bulldozed by the famous, we don't give a shit about your property. We aren't going to tag it or bag it. We're just going to destroy it and throw it into a dumpster. And there are plenty of dumpsters waiting to be hauled over. Mostly standing by, chatting with each other. Three officers and Carter Jones, as the bulldozer does its crunching nearby. I guess we should be glad they're sparing the folks. A couple of sheriffs, deputies are, who knows, maybe they're helping out. Thank you. Thank you. So a sheriff is actually helping a guy reclaim his bike, which is good, but
You know, they're also helping destroy a lot of property, so I'm afraid it does not come out even. It is going back with its loot across the desolated 4 or 7 zone, the previous zone that was removed a week ago, and to the bins of the dumpster bins that are waiting over there, and going to dump his load into the dumpster.
No.
It's we have
not
an
worthy.
Well,
and it looks like some stage of fucking moving this.
Okay,
pardon me.
Yes.
And there were very few activists there. Myself, Sea Otter, Laura, Gloria. A Sentinel photographer showed up briefly, and then I found him as I left the area, standing on the path, saying he was waiting for Jessica York. York did a long interview. Well, that's not really true. She devoted, 4 or 5 paragraphs to Bill Lowry, who spoke at length on either my last show or the show before this one, that one. There just wasn't much of the community wanted to come out in this continuous drizzle that was going on and watch this grim scene. And I admit I was less vocal than in the past. I wasn't shouting, "Stop your crazy seizure of property, that's against the law," and so forth, which I did on at least one occasion in an earlier demolition when there were more folks there to hear. There was just endless and hefty panic. This was the last area. People could no longer move into another safe zone as the city had allowed, and with the demolition of each successive phase, counting on the fact that that would stop resistance. And maybe there wouldn't have resisted anyway, because I'm not aware that anyone resisted. Well, I think I may have heard maybe one person or very few people resisting. You're going to hear later in this an interview with Keith McHenry, who talks about the issue somewhat. But he wasn't there either. Busy cooking, I would imagine. Anyway, let's hear a little Phil Oakes and try to mellow out.
When the river of rebellion overflows, I'll be there. When the seed of discontent plants and grows, I'll be there. Watching for the sun through the dark and rainy storm. Searching for the keys to the dungeons old and worn. Let me tell you, I'll be there. When the shadow of the tyrant falls and sweeps across the land. And when men would steal from others with a paper in their hand. When people toil for nothing underneath the burning sun. When their troubles would be over if they thought and fought as one. Let me tell you, I'll be there. East or west or north or south, we're brothers to the core. The wind of freedom's blowing out of every distant shore. When the time is ready and the call is loud and clear, let me tell you, I'll be there. When the thunder of oppression roars and crackles, I'll be there. And when those who would be free are wearing shackles, I'll be there. For the day is gonna come when they'll throw away their chains, lift their heads and raise their arms for the struggle that remains. And let me tell you, I'll be there. East or west or north or south, we're brothers to the core. Wind of freedom's blowing out of every distant shore. When the time is ready and the call is loud and clear, let me tell you, I'll be there. When the thunder of oppression roars and crackles, I'll be there. And when those who would be free are wearing shackles, I'll be there. For the day is gonna come when they'll throw away their chains, lift their heads and raise their arms for the struggle that remains. Let me tell you, let me tell you, let me tell you, I'll be there.
Hey, well, this is an interview I just apparently getting this turned into with Keith McHenry about 1:10 on the 1st of November. Hi, Keith.
Hi, yeah, it's Eviction Day. And, yeah, I saw several new
store downtown boarded up now with new for rent signs, so apparently that's happening. Then I did the Halloween thing. I did a little bit of a table for the Halloween people on Pacific Ave, and it was really interesting. So there was a couple of people, you know, every once in a while a good-hearted person would come by and ask about the shelters, you know.
Uh-huh.
And there would be an unhoused person near me,
uh-huh.
And they would just, it was like an immediate reaction, and it was like five different people, five different times, both five different housed people versus five different unhoused people, and the people living outside would just like go, oh my God, they're horrible, I'm never going back there, you know, they would just blurt out in this intense anger.
Well, I should let you borrow my recorder so you can record this stuff, because it's I think it's useful for any future lawsuits or something like that.
Yeah, it was really interesting how pissed off people were, man.
How long were you at the Pacific Avenue table on the Halloween?
Oh, about 5 hours or something like that.
And that was from when to when?
Oh, I went there around 2 and I stayed there till 7, actually, so however long that is.
Did the Halloween crowds come rolling out?
It was mostly the families and, you know, and stuff. And then it got cold, and I was, like, left. But, yeah, interesting thing is I put up a "We'll Be Mayor for Food" sign,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, my posters on the Good Times box next to the kiosk in front of New Leaf. And Sonia Bonner saw it, and I was talking to an abolitionist activist, a prison abolitionist activist in Boston on the phone at the time, and I see her trying to pull my poster off, and I go, "You don't touch that. That's my poster. And I didn't give you permission to touch it."
Nice.
And then I'm like, and I'm looking at the mayor, and I'm like, you know, going like, "Look, you're a violent thug, and I want you to get out of here."
All right. And what did she do?
So she's like, kind of shuddering. So then these two, Bush and one of the other cops, come up.
Before you continue, did she back off, or did she?
Well, she stopped pulling it off, yeah, I confronted her like that. And I'm still, the whole time, the woman over in Boston still listening to the whole conversation. And then, I go back to my conversation. And again, Bush and the other cop kind of were hanging around, talking to her. And then, she was claiming that the box was hers, that the Good Times box was hers. I just went on with my business once she stopped taking it down and the cops arrived. And, Bush asked me, like, "Do you got permission to be on there?" I said, "Well, I know Steve. I'm sure he doesn't mind." And then they left it there. And then it was too funny just to have all these people watching me, like, tell the mayor to go away.
Did the people know it was the mayor, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, some people did. Not everyone did. But I think it's great, you know, just to show total disrespect for these people.
Well, it was a vandal tearing down your flyer, whether it was the mayor. In fact, even more important, because the mayor is expected, if I may be so bold as to say so, to set an example.
Yeah, right.
Actually, you should have commended her and said, "Good, you should tear down all those political flyers."
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's too funny. And so I put up more in response, of course, all over everywhere. Oh, that's so funny.
So you also mentioned, Keith,
that Adams wanted to interview me about how, you know, fiscal sponsorship and stuff on the video. I'm like, okay, well.
Who interviewed you?
Brent Adams with a cell phone, you know.
He interviewed you, you say?
Yeah, not in a friendly way.
Oh, what was the reason he was calling?
He wasn't calling. He just was walking by and started taking a videotape, you know, because he was confused about that we're not a charity, but then we have a fiscal sponsor, but he didn't really seem to get that those are two different things.
It's been his impression, and he has stated on my show that you are funneling all money into a personal account when you claim it's going to a nonprofit. And you, I think, you made a response to that. Remind me of what your response to that was.
Yeah, no, it doesn't, you know, the only money that goes in my, so basically I take money out of my personal account and put it into the Food Not Bombs account and have done so for years. And so I just put $5,000 of my money I saved from, you know, Social Security into the Food Not Bombs account so I could pay the rent on the kitchen. So it's actually the opposite direction. And I only, in years, I've only kept of the money I make. Personally, I only keep $1,000 a month, and the rest I donate to Food Not Bombs. So it's actually completely the opposite way, and there was an independent Food Not Bombs bank account, which has existed since the arrest of Haight-Ashbury in 1988.
Who controls that account?
It's me and Paul and Joel, all the people that are currently controlling it.
Huh.
Before that, it was when I lived in Taos, New Mexico, was David and me and Hank that controlled it.
And how is that a sizable account or a relatively small account?
It's got like it might have $1,000 in it right now.
Yeah. So it's not a multi-million-dollar or multi-thousand-dollar account.
No, it's typically. Barely enough to pay the bills, yeah. And then we send money to, you know, we will do campaigns to raise money. So, like, we raised a bunch of money for Food Not Bombs kids in Poland right at the beginning of the war because a huge number of people were flooding into Poland. Or the most recent thing, which I just told Ron Adams, is that we sent a bunch of money to Philippines to help them with the cyclone that just happened. So,
what was Brent's response to these? First of all, how long was your Brent Adams interview?
Oh, I don't know, about like 5 minutes or something. But it was definitely accusatory. It certainly would not be wise to publish that if you want to have any credibility as Brent Adams. But
I'll ask him about it, and when I next interview him, if he, you know,
I could have come back because, you know, I have to admit that I've been hanging out with Max a lot recently. And Max eats at Food Not Bombs every day. Max lives outside still.
You're talking about Max, the man who was assaulted and then airlifted to emergency medical treatment?
Exactly. And that he raised something like $15,000 for. And maybe $20,000. The last I looked, it was about $15,000 on Brent Adams' GoFundMe for Max.
Did that get to Max's medical expenses?
Max's medical expenses are covered by the fact that he's, you know, covered.
But he's poor.
Yeah, but I would have assumed that the money would have gone to making sure he got into a hotel and had a good meal.
Did you query Brent about that issue and ask him where Max?
No. But when I talked to Max about it, he didn't know that this was even happening, that there was even a GoFundMe for him or anything about it, and no one had ever given him any money. I'm assuming that Brent will give him money at some point.
I'll ask Brent about it if I remember.
I'm hoping he did. Or maybe Max got money, and Max doesn't know that he has money, and Max, for some reason, is still living outside, and for some reason, Max is still coming to Food Not Bombs every day and hanging out with us and eating with us, which maybe if you were in an apartment, maybe he does have a hotel room, but he doesn't look like he has a hotel room, because he certainly didn't wash his hands or his face or anything, so I don't know what's going on with that, but, you know, so it's like this weird thing where, you know, he's accusing me of something, but, you know, he publicly made a crap load of money for Max, and then
you're wondering where it
Max,
went.
Yeah, Max doesn't seem to be accessing it yet, but maybe there's some problem with getting the money from GoFundMe to Brent's bank account to give to Max, or I don't know, but I just think it's a funny thing, because anybody that knows me on the streets know I'm buying like hundreds of dollars worth of pup tents. Obviously, we're paying for kitchens. We're obviously paying for gas. We're, you know, it's all done publicly at Food Not Bombs meetings. You know, it couldn't be more like obvious what the fuck's going on. It's really crazy. In fact, right now, I'm going to get money out of my own personal account to pay for the gas for Eagle. You know, so it's just the nature of life. I skim right along.
Well, how is Food Not Bombs dealing with the rain? How's that working today?
It's been tough. happens. You know, we have three awnings. Everybody's kind of, it, in a way, the fact that they've covered up the water in the fountain has been good. The only people were sitting up there. And it's a lot of people there just now. I just was there. And it's pretty impressive that many people came out in this driving of a rain to eat, you know. So that's crazy.
Well, remember that this is the day that everybody was driven away from the last segment of the Benchlands, which you were mentioning earlier, you know.
Yeah, I was talking to Kazoo about that last night. And he was, like, pretty frustrated with that, but you know, he's good natured and happy and all that. But you know, he and I were having an interesting conversation. We were talking about, like, you know, because Jeremy says that there's all these, Jeremy Leonard, who worked for the city, was saying there's all these, like, you know, Mexican gangs in there running the whole camp, blah 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 blah. So, but, and that came up in the conversation with Kazoo, because he was talking about this guy that was selling something, but he didn't really say what it was, you know. In his end of the camp, and how he had been living in the camp, but he made enough money to buy a motorcycle and move out of the camp, something like that, you know. It was like, you know, like, basically, if you got, you know, booted out of prison or something, then you've got to make a living, and that's sadly frequently the way you make a living. And, but anyway, it was an interesting conversation, because he mentioned that during the last year, you can't find heroin anymore. That everybody's just buying
fentanyl.
Fentanyl. So then I'm thinking, what an interesting coincidence. Because I remember when 9/11 happened and they announced that they were going to invade Afghanistan, I was like, you know, I thought the crack cocaine thing is going to die out. We're all going to move into the heroin thing. And then, of course, it did. It went heroin, heroin, heroin. And then, oddly enough, you know, because the crack cocaine thing was all because of all fighting wars in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and all that, and you know, using the transport of their military planes to bring it up here. And sure enough, it switched off. Crack was no longer an issue, and then it became heroin. But as soon as the U.S. is kicked out of Afghanistan, it's to fentanyl. It's really interesting how, you know, maybe it's just a coincidence that all the heroin just stopped coming over from Afghanistan at the same time the U.S., you know, got kicked out of the country. But it seems suspicious. You know, very interesting.
Now, you also mentioned originally when you called me right before we began this conversation on record that you drove by River Street and saw across the river the consequences of the rain and what looked to you like flooding of the entire lower but now depopulated section of the campground. Is that it?
Yeah, it's like right behind the county building. I was driving along Water Street, actually, and you could see a puddle that was looked quite deep that went all the way from the, you know, like the bike path part that goes under the bridge on the Water Street Bridge, about, you know, way up that end of the park. And
that's even before the fenced area then. Or was that all the fenced area that you saw that was flooded?
Yeah, it was. Well, it's where, like, you know, it was that end of the benchlands, like. So it's the area that flooded when we were doing food op bombs. At the, you know, they kicked us down there on the, you know, from the at the beginning of COVID.
Yeah, it was behind fences. In other words, it was one of the first phases, phase one or two, that was cleared out and fenced.
Yeah, so it's actually, it's the one and two are flooded completely at this point.
I mean, it's interesting because I know in the actual December, January, whenever it was flood of earlier this year or earlier, late last year, it was the other end that was really flooded, that people were, you know, actually concerned that they might actually be trapped there. And I guess that's what I thought you originally meant. But
yeah, well, that might be also. I mean, I wasn't down at that end, so I don't know. Uh-huh. I just happened to be driving by.
That was the end that was, depopulated today.
Correct.
In the last of the demolitions. Have you... I guess when you were at the table, that was yesterday, so the camp was still in existence, part of it anyway, while you were there.
Yeah, Kazoo was in that part of the camp, and that's why we were, one of the things why we were talking with each other about that, what they're anticipating this morning.
You haven't seen Troy, have you?
Oh, I haven't seen him in a little while. I saw him riding a bike past me on Pacific like a couple of days ago, but I haven't seen him since.
Okay, that's I was just wondering, because he's... We're trying to. He was helping a group of us get together people's names and contacts for either a lawsuit or for some kind of future connection continuity, so that we can get maybe some warning that there's another camp gathering and that they're going to start sweeping, and then you know, Robbie Powell.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of camps that haven't started sweeping yet, but I anticipate if what they're saying in the media is true, that they will sweep them soon.
Yeah,
and I would not be surprised if the rain keeps going and gets really, really heavy for a while, then some of those camps are going to be washed away, and those people are going to have to move up to higher ground. But
Poganip is now, you know, more and more camps are appearing that are visible from the road as you drive into town.
And you can see them on all sides, it's crazy.
Any events coming up with either Food Not Bombs or Food Not Bombs sponsored, although I don't know how much sponsoring Food Not Bombs is doing because you're kind of occupied with the daily meal, which goes on and on. Any news of that, or also any news of other meals opening up that might be of help to people who are, you know, outside and looking, they can no longer cook their own food easily, particularly in the rain.
Yeah, this is like a mess. But no, I don't think St. Francis has started doing indoor foods yet. Every once in a while I hear rumor they might do it shortly, but that doesn't seem like they have yet.
Red Church meal is no longer happening anymore. There's no Monday thing anymore.
No, that's not happening. And the street team people moved over to the Resource Center for Nonviolence. They're meetings, but so they do that.
What's your take on the street people's team? Have you got any sense of how well that's either helping or hurting unaffiliated homeless folks on the street?
I think that there's the biggest thing about that is camaraderie of the people, but otherwise, and they still get their like coupons for McDonald's and stuff like that. But the main person I ever talked to that is both Blue and Russell, they are involved. So I think there's some kind of like stability that's offered to that, but not the housing and everything that they put in.
And you're talking about the people who are working with the streets team. I guess what I was asking is not based so much on what's the impact of the streets team on other homeless people, or does it have any impact?
I think, people that are not working with them have no interaction with them, other than just as, you know, the regular people that live outside have interaction with them, but it's no way related to being in the street team.
What's happened to the, if you learn, you probably haven't. We were, I guess, one person was mentioning to me that what with the demolition of the last of the benchlands, the porta potties are going to disappear completely. And that's without being.
They've already disappeared, haven't they? I didn't see any.
Well, they were put up on the path, at least for phase 7, the previous phase last week, they were still there. But I don't know. I mean, you may have noticed that they were gone. I didn't notice today. When I was down there myself when the benchlands was being closed, let me ask Gloria, did you notice if the porta potties were still there when you were?
They were the middle part, remember, before the bridge.
Right, they were still there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm wondering if the porta potties, which had been moved onto the upper path, midway through the demolition of the phases, are going to be gone completely, which means porta-potties, I mean, these people have not disappeared. Brent Adams claims to the contrary, probably notwithstanding, unless he's accurate, which I suppose he might be. He thinks that a third of those people are, you know, people who have moved in as part of the drug trade. And who've just lived there, and as a sort of a, because they can sell drugs to folks in the camp, and that therefore that they're going to disappear when the camp disappears, that they have other, actually they have housed places to go to. What's your take on that analysis?
And we'll catch his take on the issue of drug population in the former benchlands in a moment. Here's a little more Phil Oakes.
Here's a song in A minor of 5 in K-Ball. It's called Paul Crump. It tells the story of a man who killed another man in Chicago in 1953. And while he was sitting in jail, he began appealing his sentence and winning, and began educating himself, wrote a novel called Burn, Killer, Burn. And just last year, his sentence was commuted by the governor of Illinois. Now he's still sitting, he's still in jail there now, and this case will be used a lot in arguments about rehabilitation versus capital punishment. In the state of Illinois, about 9 years ago, a cold-blooded killer, he went against the law. He killed a factory guard when his robbery did fail, and they caught him and they threw him into jail. He lay there in his cell, locked up with his hate. Not many men knew of him and less cared for his fate. And he knew no peace of mind when his trial did come by. The judge said, "You are guilty, you must die." But Paul Crump is alive today. He's a-sittin' in a cell. He's got something to say. Every human's got something to give. And if a man can change, then a man should live. They sent him to Cook County Jail, a jail known far and wide, where pity was a stranger and brave men often cried. He led a prison riot in the year of 55, and he didn't even care if he survived. But the jail had a new warden, Jack Johnson was his name. To cure instead of punish, it was his chosen aim. The riot soon was ended, the convicts feared in vain. The warden gave them hope instead of pain. But Paul Crump is alive today. He's a-sittin' in a cell. He's got something to say. Every human's got something to give. And if a man can change, then a man should live. Between the warden and the convict, a friendship slowly grew. One learned from the other that a man can live anew. Then the warden told the convict, "You must leave the devil's plan. The time has come for you to be a man." Then the convict found religion and he started in to learn. He wrote himself a novel called Burn, Killer, Burn. And as his dying day grew near, to the warden he did cry, "You must pull the switch if I must die." But Paul Crump is alive today. He's a-sittin' in a cell. He's got something to say. Every human's got something to give. And if a man can change, then a man should live. It was up to Governor Kerner to keep him from the grave. Was rehabilitation a reason to be saved? The people were protesting, the word was spread around, a new and better answer must be found. Well, the electric chair was cheated, the convict didn't pay, a new concept of justice was born and raised that day. Now throughout this peaceful land, there are others set to die. What better time than now to question why? 'Cause Paul Crump is alive today. He's a-sittin' in a cell. He's got something to say. Every human's got something to give. And if a man can change, then a man should live.
Actually housed dealers and then hired, so to speak.
to sell stuff to distribute in the camp. So I get the impression they were sort of like that's basically the way it worked. It wasn't like that there were, and it wasn't like Mexican. I mean, there were definitely like, you know, what they call Little Tijuana down there. You know, there was people connected to the Spanish-speaking community that delivered to there, and then they distributed there. And then, you can see it openly when you're walking down there, you know, how the different communities are. Then there was an African-American community that was doing some kind of other operation partially, and they were busy doing what they were doing. And then, you know, so, but it seemed like the way the trafficking was from house people distributing to people that actually were legitimately living in the camp, and this is how they would, you know, finance their
addiction. Well, I guess my point here is that I have a couple that's interesting to hear your perspective, which sounds like it's different than Brent's and definitely different than Jeremy's, who I think was very much afraid of, I don't know, he expressed fears about being assaulted by drug lords and people.
Well, he's going to get assaulted by just anybody at all because everybody hated his fucking guts.
many people were hostile, some weren't, but many were. And I know he was not on the scene. A week ago, he was on the scene only an hour later after it had started, and then I guess, at least that's what I saw. I think I challenged him in that regard, but he and I have been, shall we say, developing more of a adversarial relationship recently. And then people were looking for him to get housing today, because I was down there at 9 o'clock when they started this demolition, well, 8:40 or something, and he wasn't there. So there was that problem, although he said one guy who I talked to briefly said that Jeremy had said that they were full up yesterday. And
yeah, I think you get the sense that generally they're full all the time since this clearing has happened. But then what ends up happening is people become so pissed off at what's going on, they leave and then new people come in. So I think it's basically for a couple of weeks now been essentially, other than maybe what they do, I guess they keep four tents available in the Overlook, and they keep like a couple of tents available at 1220 River, and then I think they keep a couple of beds available so that they can say that there is a place for someone when they're harassing them on the streets. And then
are those numbers speculative, or do you have a basis for saying those numbers, 4 and 2?
That's what I recall from, you know, city council or city manager reports. But who knows if that stays real or anything. You know, that just seems to be,
the point I was making.
Who even knows if that was real ever?
Yeah, well, that's true. A report is a report, and the reality is something else. But I guess the porta potty thing that I mentioned, I guess my concern is I don't think they're going to. I don't know. I'm wondering what's going to happen when those porta potties are gone, because I don't think the hundreds of people who lived in the benchlands are gone. You know, that's what I'm. And so that means there are no facilities and much more people without even a pot to shit in, and which, of course, you might say is nothing new, but because of the increased homeless population, it's going to be even more of a burden on the poor dog walkers who are going to, you know, have to deal with doggies dealing with homeless people on the streets. I mean,
yeah, well, the thing that's very strange is, of course, by you know, they had 2 years to actually figure out some kind of places for people to safely go. They didn't really do anything. You know, they just emptied the places they already had and then put people back in the places they already had. I guess the only, you know, they, and it was very fascinating. It seemed like the so-called leadership of down in the benchlands, like people like Greg, got offered tiny homes over at Housing Matters, so to keep them quiet, I guess. And that's typical. That kind of reminds me of that guy in, you know, that ended up handing out Camp Agnos T-shirts in '89. That's the dude's name. But he was like, they lent him an apartment and a Suzuki car or something.
This is up in
San. He became the official spokesperson for all the homeless in the camp, and he would spin it the way the government wanted it.
This was up
they were trying to trash Agnos.
This was up in San Francisco at the
Civic
Center, and when there was a camp that the Examiner called Camp Agnos, it was and Food Not Bombs set up an operation where you fed 24 hours a day. Well, how come you can't feed 24 hours a day anymore, Keith?
Because I turned 65 and I'm old. So, God, it's amazing we've been out. We'll be out there, like on the, I guess the 10th of December, we'll be doing meals every day for 1,000 days. So that's not too,
it's not too shabby.
No. So, God, we're hoping St. Francis opens up because maybe we could change our operation. But at the rate things are going, the amount of I did 11 5-gallon trays of food on Sunday by myself. Essentially, I did have some help from Blue. He made the rice and he boiled the pinto beans. But
how does that compare with a year ago?
Oh, a year ago was like. You know, even like within the past year, it's gone from the most we usually did 7 5-gallon trays, and now we're doing, 10 for sure every day. So, and sometimes we run out often really fast. And on the days where we don't make 10, basically if we get there at 1 o'clock, it can be gone by 2. So it's growing and growing, and then the paper products, is another measurement of how much food is going. Because we're going through paper products like crazy, and yesterday was really cool though. The concert was great, man. That was incredible.
And what concert was that?
Every holiday we do a free concert at the Mio, and the next one is Veterans Day on the 11th. Of November, 11 days from now.
And this was the Halloween concert you're talking about.
Yeah, this was the Halloween concert.
Was there a lot of costumes and face painting and such?
Yeah, there was all of that. And the band is really top-notch now. So I think we've figured out that. So Jay was one of the guitarists, and it was good. God, it was great. So that's happening. And... I ran into a person stopped by the table on Civic to tell me he was wearing all kinds of wacky clothes because he had gone to Coral Street to take a shower, came back, and his RV was towed, and he lost everything.
Oh, boy.
Get back. So that's pretty common.
Where was his RV parked,
He was on Delaware. It looks like they're going to take all the vehicles on Delaware. Everybody was tagged on Delaware.
And there's no Nomad or other groups that are defending them anymore?
Not that I'm aware of. I think, what ends up kind of happening is all those particular people are, they're doing the electrovoltic stuff, not particularly the most negative things, but, trying to get the empty houses law passed and trying to stop the library project and getting, couple of city councilors elected or something, or a mayor, or whatever.
Joy Schindeldecker campaign versus your friend Fred Keeley.
Yeah. I ran into Fred yesterday walking up and down with his wife on Pacific Ave. That was interesting.
Did he give you a hug, perhaps? Did he give you a hug?
I reminded him that I had already won the election and I was the mayor because I was actually feeding people and actually providing water, clothing, and housing. And those are kinds of things that mayors do.
Really? I've never known a mayor who did such a thing.
No mayor ever does do those kind of things. But if a mayor was going to be a mayor that actually did something for the community, those would be things mayors would do. Rather than what they normally do, which is
nothing.
Get lots of money from you and give it to their rich friends. That's a typical mayor thing.
You're not accusing Mayor Bruner of corruption, are you?
No, she isn't even up to the level of corruption, unfortunately. that's unfortunate, but true.
So did the other candidate, Joy Schindeldecker, pass by your table?
No, she did not, no. Huh. And I actually called Chris Crone to get flyers for, yes on O and stuff, but nobody came by. People were, you know, asking about it. So, yeah, funny.
Interesting.
Funny world out there. And no one was dressed in underwear with a hammer, which I would have thought there'd be tons of people like that, but nobody did that.
Underwear with a hammer. What would that signify?
Oh, that would be the, you know, just building on the Pelosi jokes, you know.
I know that her husband was assaulted, and that the guy wanted to hammer Pelosi. Is that the idea?
What it looks like from the initial reports from actual, you know, from the police department and from the 911 calls and stuff like that, was that there were some people having sex in Pelosi's house, and it went bad, and they got ended up in a fight over drugs, is what the initial story was. Of course, that's been spun to something different to help the...
Where did you hear this from?
That was just a normal... I just watched online the chief of police give my first press conference, and I listened to the 911 tape, and read the affidavit. So that's what it looks like. And saw the photos.
Are you claiming that those who are warning about a conspiracy against dear Nancy Pelosi and her husband are in fact spinning something in, should we say, a false direction?
Oh, that the Pelosi and the Democrats are, yeah, for sure. They're trying to bail their ass out of that. But it was pretty obvious. Well, I mean, who breaks into a house in his underwear with two hammers? the official story is that the cops walked in, there was Paul and David. They were, Paul had a hammer, David took the hammer from Paul in front of the cop, according to the police report. And then there was actually nothing happened after that, although somehow both individuals ended up in the hospital, and both are currently in the hospital.
Now, Paul is Pelosi's husband, and David is the alleged aggressor, right?
Yeah, right. And David is now they're calling him homeless, but at the time he was, if you just want to call him homeless, he was living apparently in a bus in Berkeley, and the photos of his house show that he has Black Lives, or the place where the bus was parked, has Black Lives Matter posters all over it, and the gay flag, and the prominent thing in the front, and, you know, so, but, I mean, at the very first moments of the story were, according to the San Francisco Police Department, was that the officer was let into the place by somebody. They went in further, and there was Paul Pelosi and this other guy, David DePapa, and David DePapa was trying to wrestle a hammer out of Paul Pelosi's hands, and then that's where it kind of stopped. So you don't, and then some reason he's got a, you know, both of them are injured, and the timeline originally of how Paul Pelosi got a fractured skull was not evident in the original press conference by the chief of police. It was basically, and the narrative ends with David DePapa pulling the hammer out of Paul's hand. So that's just what was happening. You know, I'm just like reporting what the original report.
And is that report still online?
Oh yeah, I'm sure you can go look at Google all the press statements, and theoretically it'll be there. Then it somehow gets spun a different way, but it's not clear. And then also, if you watch the district attorney's press conference of yesterday, it just makes you wonder what's going on, because the complaint has multiple stories that all contradict each other. So you can read that online too. Or at least it was online yesterday. I don't know if it's still online now. But yeah, so it's like very confused as to what's going on. So it looks like the claim that he definitely is not a MAGA anybody, and definitely not a QAnon, anybody, this guy Dave, but he's just appears to be just a, he's like a, hangs out at this house in his bus, and there he's having news parties and stuff like that, and that's what the, at least the initial statements are. The current, and then you can see that the, it's very unusual, it seems very weird that a guy in his underwear would have climbed up the wall and climbed over the balcony into the where the broken glass that keeps showing videos of and break the glass, which for some reason when they broke the glass, it mostly went outside on the patio. According to the videos that the AP and everybody is showing.
Well, I'm going to leave this sordid tale here.
The weird thing, it's very funny if nothing else. I think it's one of the funniest things, and who knows how this is going to get, definitely they're spinning it to bolster their, January 6th event thing that they put on, and then to try to, some kind of, this is sort of like the Oklahoma bombing version of the new crime bill thing trying to put in this new domestic extremist bill, which basically is going after anybody that's critical of the government in any way or corporate power.
Any word of a successful legal action defending homeless encampments throughout the state? I know that there was lawsuits filed in San Francisco, but it hasn't really gotten very far yet. And, of course, I guess Robbie Powelson is assisted in lawsuits in the North Bay, but I'm not sure how successful they are currently in their current status. And I think Chico got a settlement finally. I talked to one of the ACLU guys who, reported on that to me unofficially, of course. But anyway.
I don't have any information on homeless sweeps. I do know that there was a recent report that an appellate court upheld a conviction for a law, making it illegal to hand out food in St. Louis.
Right, I read that.
And then there's a woman at in Arizona, I guess she just lost her case. But I only just heard that from Joe Schultz from India Joe just about 20 minutes ago or just before we got on the phone. So I haven't followed up to see where that's at. But I've been, she was really cool in the interviews I've seen of her. Norma, and I forget her last name, but she'd been cooking with some other people that ran a soup kitchen, and then she just was so upset about what was going on, she started feeding people at a picnic area. And then she, at some point, I guess she had already had like an event there without a permit, but it was not homeless people officially. Or at least the authorities assumed it was just their friends, so you don't need a permit to have a picnic there. But when it became homeless people, then you did need a permit or you couldn't even get a permit. You just plain weren't allowed to meet people there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting how that kind of thing goes on.
Sounds
so
funny.
We're hoping that doesn't become normalized, where it starts to arrest people for meeting people like they did in the past. But could be. Our meeting is about to start here for Brave and Free, so I better sign off.
Now, just a moment. What is this meeting before you sign off?
Oh, it's a meeting to defend our rights. We have an organization called Brave and Free to push back on all the totalitarian laws.
Is this here in Santa Cruz, or?
Yeah, it's for Santa Cruz County, Brave and Free. Yeah.
And how can people get more information about this?
If they go to bravenfreesantacruz.org, and that's the website that we're actually still working on. But we meet the second and fourth Tuesdays of the month at Aptos Grange at about 6 o'clock.
Sounds good, and I will I'll pass that on. And thanks for taking the time again, Keith, as ever.
Great. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, man.
Bye-bye.
So that's it for the local snapshots, commentary, and interview.
Signing off before I become completely hoarse. I'm going to play you the audio of the video of Aaron Mate's on-contact interview with a professor, Richard Sakwa, I think his name is, on the Ukraine situation. The two of them explain it much better than I, and I'm going to leave that as a kind of my parting shot after a little bit of, well, concluding Phil Oak.
The story of William Worthy. William Worthy is a reporter for the Baltimore Afro-American and the Realist in New York. And he went down to Cuba a while ago. When he got back, he was arrested. He came back to Florida. He was arrested for illegal reentry to the United States because it's against the law for Americans to go to Cuba or China or several other places. So he's running around the country appealing and making speeches, getting all kinds of support. So here's the ballad of William Worthy. Well, it's of a bold reporter, a story I will tell. He went down to the Cuban land, the nearest place to hell. He'd been there many times before, but now the law does say the only way to Cuba is with the CIA. William Worthy isn't worthy to enter our door. Went down to Cuba, he's not American anymore. But somehow it is strange to hear the State Department say, you are living in the free world you must stay. $5,000 or a 5-year sentence may well be for a man who had the nerve to think that traveling is free. He should have listened closer when he heard the experts say this modern world is getting so much smaller every day. William Worthy isn't worthy to enter our door. Went down to Cuba, he's not American anymore. But somehow it is strange to hear the State Department say, you are living in the free world you must stay. So come all you good travelers and fellow travelers too, and travel all around the world, see every country through. I'd surely like to come along and see what may be new, but my passport's disappearing as I sing these words to you. Well, there really is no need to travel to these evil lands. And though the list grows larger, you must try to understand and try hard not to worry if someday you should hear that the whole world is off limits. Visit Disneyland this year. William Worthy isn't worthy to enter our door. Went down to Cuba, he's not American anymore. But somehow it is strange to hear the State Department say, you are living in the free world you must stay.
Welcome to Pushback. I'm Aaron Mate. Joining me is Richard Sakwa. He is professor of Russian and European politics at the University of Kent. His books include Frontline Ukraine, Crisis in the Borderlands, and his latest, Deception, Russiagate, and the New Cold War. Richard Sakwa, good to see you again.
Welcome.
It's been a while since we spoke on Pushback about what's going on in Ukraine, so I'm just wondering at this point your assessment of where we're at when it comes to the war inside Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the first thing to say is a short assessment of the military situation. Obviously, I'm no military expert, but quite clearly, the talk of Ukrainian victory, with almost a smell of victory, almost seems to be in the air. And that was obviously because the Kharkov offensive in September, the offensive now around Kherson, which had been promised throughout the summer, is actually taking place. However, I think that this gave certain illusions of the fact that ultimately Russia was on the run. This certainly is not the case. We do know that there's the partial mobilization announced on the 21st of September. I mean, the word partial is conditional because quite clearly through that announced 300,000 reservists to be called up, you know, maybe more, maybe less. So far, they're saying that the actual mobilization is complete, 240,000. By the time they're trained, not necessarily sent to the front, some will be, of course, but they will be able to take back positions, certainly perhaps in particular in the Far East, and there's plenty of forces which Russia then could move over to the Western Front. So you know, we are anticipating a major Russian offensive once the ground freezes. At the moment, of course, there is an offensive around in Donetsk, around Bakhmut, and that part of the world. So the military balance is unclear. That the idea of a Ukrainian victory, but of course their ambitions now are, and in fact both sides are unclear what their end game is. On the Ukrainian side, of course, we have two important developments. The first one is the radicalization of the demand, that the goal is not just to push Russia back to where it was the day before the 24th of February invasion, but also to liberate, as I'd say, deoccupy the Donetsk and indeed Crimea. So that is obviously an important fact. And the second one is the, you know, three major, you know, events. The assassination of Darya Dugina, of course, the target was her father, Alexander Dugin the Great, as it were, scourge of the West. The second thing is the explosions on the Nord Stream pipeline, which are absolutely extraordinary. The idea, and I've heard senior British officials say, threaten to eat their hat if it wasn't Russia responsible for it. Well, I'm afraid that these officials will be having a diet of hat, because it's quite clear that Russia would not blow up its own pipelines. Interestingly enough, the very day it took place, there appear to have been negotiations between Germany and Russia on perhaps, you know, not immediately opening the pipelines, but some sort of pathway towards that. I mean, who knows what was actually stated. And, of course, the third thing is the attack on the Kerch bridge to Crimea.
It's amazing how quickly things move, that it's easy to forget now that somebody blew up the Nord Stream pipelines, a major international act of sabotage with far-reaching consequences, and now it's barely discussed because there's not much interest, at least in the Western world, to find out really who did it, and so many other things just keep happening. This war keeps escalating. Let me ask you about...
Can I just say one more thing on that? And that is that, you know, the specific act... clearly, as you say, it's moved on. The agenda seems to have moved on, even though, you know, just a physical act itself was quite extraordinary, because it takes a lot of dynamite, a lot of explosive, and a lot of technology to do it. So it was major state actor was almost certainly involved. I'm not going to point the finger now, but as I'm sure we all have our suspicions. But the larger point I wanted to make is what this tells us about Germany and Germany in the new Europe. Because clearly this was an attack on Germany. Its flexibility, I'm not saying it was going to open these pipelines soon, but certainly now the option, well, there's one line out of the four, can potentially be used. But it has reduced Germany, and of course it has huge economic consequences, and of course it is the end of 50 years of German engagement with Russia on the energy front, which is in an extraordinary way now, this has been extraordinarily beneficial for both sides. And yet the United States, of course, from the very beginning, back in the 1980s, was opposed to it. Well, they've finally achieved their goal, and you know, what it tells us then, even larger about European Union and its own ability to articulate its own needs outside and above, but not against, of course, the larger Western alliance.
What you?
Ooh, my patchouli's wearing off.
Oh, my favorite shirt is ruined.
Human.
Whoa. You smell amazing.
Thanks. It's Native. Clean, simple, effective deodorant. It's not a myth. It's Native.
Take me to the ocean. Take me to the sea.
What do you think happened to Germany? Angela Merkel oversaw the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Germany committed to doing it. Promised Russia that they would see it through, even in the face of U.S. pressure. Angela Merkel leaves and Olaf Scholz comes in, and you find him standing next to Joe Biden in early February, and that's when Biden declares that if Russia invades Ukraine, then we will stop Nord Stream 2 no matter what. And he's asked by a reporter, well, how can you do that if it's not in your territory? And Biden says, you know, trust me, we'll find a way. And he's saying that right next to the German chancellor. How did Germany go from, you know, enthusiastically being a partner in Nord Stream 2 to watching it being sabotaged and not saying anything and actually openly participating in it?
Yeah. I mean, initially, Scholz demurred, and then, you know, within 24 hours, his position changed radically, and he went along with the Biden line. Of course, in part, that's a function of the coalition dynamics, because obviously he's, I was going to say shackled, but allied with the Greens, who have always been, well, both for the energy transition issues, of course, they want to see carbon reduction, but they are particularly, the tradition of the Greens has been very strongly, militantly even anti-Russian for various reasons, and some good ones, including human rights issues, but also bad ones, which I would argue a certain geopolitical naivety, and of course the other Free Democrat partners. And, of course, Scholz's inexperience as chancellor, though he's a very experienced leader, as formerly in Hamburg. Yeah, indeed, it's a thing. And, of course, you could say this was a delayed time bomb because of Merkel's failure to resolve the larger issue. And one could theoretically sort of say, look, we're all suffering today from the Ukrainization of Western politics. I don't mean that abusively. I just simply technically wants to say that, you know, this whole context, this whole issue has led to a certain extremism, which was already apparent within the model of Ukrainian state formation already from 91, but even later, the Western Ukrainians militantly anti-Russian. And there seems to be no limit to their demands, which, of course, is very odd that Washington should be, as it were, in hock to these demands, as if Kiev's concerns and interests and national interests are 100% aligned with those of the United States. Of course, you could say it's the other way around, and the United States is driving it as well. But we're into this escalatory cycle, and Germany is the victim, and, of course, all of Western Europe is the victim to it, not just energy, but food, and ultimately, as far as I'm concerned, political autonomy. European Union has been transformed by this conflict. It has become now, and is effectively becoming, a military alliance, which is exactly opposite what we, and me personally, over the years, was always in favour of the European Union as a peace project, as a way of overcoming the logic of conflict on the European continent. And that's why, after 1989, I was always saying, well, you've managed to make war between France and Germany almost inconceivable. Well, do the same now, guys, with Moscow, with Russia. You've got the challenge. Russia is receptive. I've just been reading, and I'm at the moment reading, Philip Short's magnificent biography of Putin, in which he reminds us and gives us the full text, well, larger text, of the David Frost interview with Putin in March 2000, where Putin begins by saying, you know, that he finds it inconceivable for Russia to be not part of what, you know, of Western civilization. First, second, ask, can Russia join NATO? He said, and why not? But went on to say, as long as it was treated as an equal partner and all of that sort of language. And we've moved from there to where Europe was, you know, ready and open to, well, we were all open to a positive peace agenda to where we are today in a very dangerous hot war.
When you spoke about the Ukrainization of Western politics, can you speak more about the plurality inside of Ukraine and how Western policy basically seeks to erase it and the Ukrainian people, as defined by Western politicians, is essentially just one contingent inside of Ukraine, the nationalists who you spoke about, and how the U.S. has exploited that to pursue its own goals inside of Ukraine to basically use it as a proxy against Russia?
Yes, very much so. I've been, and we all are, I suppose, have been accused often of denying Ukraine agency in all of this, as you say, a proxy and all the rest. Well, it of course, it's important not to, you know, denigrate the ability of Ukraine to decide. But who decides? And this is exactly the point to which I'm thinking absolutely right to raise that. I mean, I've been arguing for many, many years that Ukraine, and that is its wealth and that is its achievement, is made up of many different viewpoints, ideological and indeed, you know, demographically, ethnically, even if you like. And this isn't a negative, it's a plus. And but the catastrophe and the failure has been to institutionalize all of that at the constitutional level. Until recently, you know, language, even though they weren't allowed at schools and education and public life at the private level, it was, you know, allowed, and of course it is today. But it needed to be instantiated in some sort of constitutional settlement, which would then have made all the communities partners in, which would love to see nation and state building in a free, democratic, sovereign Ukraine. But they messed it up big time, in my view. I know this goes against the trend of most Ukrainian experts who buy into a different model of state building, the one pursued in Estonia and Latvia, which again has undergone much criticism. You can understand the context, of course, but in the Ukraine, the idea of applying that sort of, if you like, remedial state building, okay, we need to go back, we need to get rid of Russian influence, you know, this in the Soviet form or, and imperial form, is just simply a recipe for the disaster which we have today. So, you know, I always ask, we needed this sort of genuine, how can I, pluralism within Ukraine, instead of which we have a monist. And, of course, it was reflected in politics. Even today, I saw a statistic not long ago, and Vladimir Ishchenko shows this, that, you know, views on NATO membership have been divided. Views, even as late as early 2014, on whether Ukraine should join the European Union, or a sign up to the association agreement, or the Russian-led Eurasian Economic Union, that there was still a very large constituency for the latter. And, you know, obviously today it's much smaller with, almost non-existent, one would imagine, in the bits which are not part of Russia. And, of course, that is the other major development, which is the referendums and the incorporation of these four regions into the Russian state, which, in my view, has Ukrainized the Russian state as well now, because, again, not derogatory, but simply to say that in softening the borders of Russia today, then there's a possibility of a blowback which may ultimately undermine the very foundations of Russian statehood in the future. And of course, the language for that nowadays is so-called decolonization of within Russia itself. So we're in a moment of incredible, well, let's use the word liminality. Everything is open. And of course, how this could go, you know, could be devastating for Russia. And of course, it is devastating for Ukraine today.
When it comes to these annexations of these four Ukrainian territories by Russia, do you have a sense of what the level of popular support for joining Russia actually is? I gather from what I've read about Crimea, which Russia annexed in 2014, that popular support there for joining Russia was pretty overwhelming. I feel confident saying that. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. But in terms of these newly annexed territories, is it similar to Crimea, or do you think there's more opposition to Russia there than these results of these referendums might suggest?
You're absolutely right about Crimea. A number of independent and above all German public opinion polling agencies did run, you know, what are considered very respectable opinion polls in Crimea, and it shows a very large majority in favor of what they would call reunification with Russia. So Crimea is a special case, which of course makes the Ukrainian demand to, you know, deoccupy it particularly dangerous. What would they do with the population? And then of the four, we need to distinguish between Lugansk and Donetsk, which, of course, for the last, since 2014, have been, initially under the control of what would be called autonomists, but then later on separatists. And there, the vote and the idea support for joining Russia is one of the demands which their leaders have been putting forward for many years. And that's, of course, Sergei Naryshkin, the head of the Russian SVR, the Foreign Intelligence Service, stumbled on the 21st of February meeting when he said, yes, let's incorporate them. And Putin then said, well, we're not talking about that now. It's just their independence. So one would expect, you know, maybe not as high as the figures, which are clearly inflated, but a significant body of people do want to join Russia because that would mean the payment of pensions, the delivery of services, if we could get to some peacetime situation. However, in Zaporozhye and Kherson, it's very different. It's Ukrainian authorities, Kiev says, it's no more than 5% in support. Russia said something over 90. Both figures are absurd. It's, and I think your intuition is right, we don't know. I mean, but we do know that there is a significant body of opinion which will welcome it. And, of course, we do know also a body that will deeply oppose it. So this is the point. It's where there's always been this element of civil war, which at the same time, which has now become an interstate war. So there's these two things going on, which, of course, and civil wars are the worst wars because, as we saw in former Yugoslavia, and, of course, the Russian civil war, the savagery involved in a civil war is often surpasses that in an interstate war.
Yeah, and this gets back to my question of earlier in terms of the different identities inside of Ukraine, but one of them we're just not allowed to recognize here in the West, which is the ethnic Russians or people who identify with Russia, who live primarily in the East, who, you know, were the base of support for Yanukovych when he won the presidency, and then were angered when he was ousted back in 2014 in a U.S.-backed uprising or coup, depending on your perspective. And it's those ethnic Russians that we're not really allowed to think about or believe have agency. It's only essentially, as far as I understand the U.S. policies, is we're only supposed to basically be aligned with the nationalist component that is based in the west of Ukraine.
Absolutely. I remember traveling through the Donbass in 2008 and was astonished to see, you know, on, you know, build public buildings, gas holders and the like, NATO net, no to NATO, back in 2008, because obviously the promise for NATO membership was in the Bucharest summit in April 2008. So it really led to a very sharp reaction, even then, way before all of this. But you're absolutely right, there is a Russophone element there, which, you know, various statistics, we haven't had a census since 2001, but 20% or maybe 18-20% of the population were earlier ethnic Russians. Russian language was prevalent, but at least 60% of the population were fluent and used it in most communications, including Zelensky himself until recently and the leadership. But can I just make, there is this Russophone constituency, but what makes this tragedy even worse is that and this is opinion polls, Kiev Institute, International Institute of Sociology, in late 2013, and again in early 2014, showed that even in the Donbass, the demand, the desire was for autonomy, not separation. That the Russophone population were quite, in my view, you know, it's good that they wanted to be part of this sovereign, independent, democratic Ukraine, but they wanted their concerns to be addressed. So it wasn't separatism, it was autonomy. And in a sense, this is what would have been the sensible way forwards, even after the coup, if you want to call it that, or we want to call it that, of February 2014. This is what so astonished so many in the Donbass, they told me this, that when Poroshenko, who was elected in May, but before that, provisional government launched the anti-terrorist operation, as it was called, against its own people in the Donbass, plus the abuse, calling them Sovoks, delegitimating their identity, their very language, their culture as backward, demodernized, you know, an absolute drag. I mean, this was just extraordinary language, which most people would find unacceptable if we used it about any community in England or the United States, yet it passed without comment by so many in the West. And that takes me back once again to Angela Merkel and her failure to push genuinely for the implementation of Minsk II, which was a way, of course, pushed by Moscow, for that autonomy to be granted within this democratic free sovereign Ukraine. So there was nothing wrong about Minsk II, other than the fact that it may have put a block on NATO enlargement, as if that's the most important thing in the universe, NATO enlargement, which, you know, as far as Ukrainians were concerned, they were divided on this issue. So, you know, again, the West was driving an agenda and not criticizing, and Merkel's failure, genuinely, to push what... I understand why people didn't want Minsk II and so on. We all know that. But ultimately, it was the rational thing to do. Moscow was pushing these people to go back to Ukraine with a degree of autonomy and their language rights and so on. Well, that's normal. Canada has it. Northern Italy, Alto Adige, has it. We in the United Kingdom have given devolution to Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland. And it's fantastic. Let them develop their cultures, their peoplehood, if you like, nationhood, within the framework of this larger unity. You know, there's all sorts of variable geometry that could have been applied, instead of which we've got this monolithic, monist vision, NATO enlargement, joining the West, and that means turning your back against Russia.
Yes, when these breakaway republics, Donetsk and Luhansk, voted for autonomy back in 2014, I believe it was.
Yes, it was May 2014, if I'm not mistaken, 17th of April.
Russia responded by asking them not to hold those votes and refused to actually recognize them, right? They, you know, wanting to keep those regions
Putin
apart.
Was against it personally. He said, don't do it. And they went ahead with it. So it wasn't as if they were totally puppets in the hand of Moscow, which is the usual way of seeing them.
Recently, Poroshenko, who signed Minsk, made a comment that I think can be interpreted as an admission that he had no intention of actually following Minsk II. He said that it gave us 8 years to delay the war, essentially.
How did the negotiations in Minsk end? We achieved what we wanted. We didn't trust Putin then, and we don't now. Our task was to avert the threat or to delay the war. It was necessary to get 8 years for us to restore economic growth and build up a powerful military. This was the first task, and it was achieved.
What is the result of the Minsk agreement? We win 8 years to create army. We win 8 years to restore economy.
Who do you fault primarily for the failure of Minsk II, the peace agreement that was reached in 2015 to end the civil war in the Donbass that began the year prior after the U.S.-backed coup with the Maidan? And is there any possible of it being revived today, or is that over?
On the first point, Poroshenko's statement is shocking. But of course, it was only a statement of reality, because they've spent the Ukraine, instead of building a new nation, incorporating these people in the last 7 or 8 years, they were building a war machine. So they built, of course, vast fortifications across the western part of the Donbass. They built up an army. They, instead of building reconciliation, they built war, a war machine with the support of the West. And then, of course, offensive weapons were finally... Obama refused to deliver offensive weapons, and then Trump did, of course. The so-called Putin stooge was the one who was the most militant. So the Putin... As for the who was responsible, Zelensky, of course, as we know, was elected in 2019 with 73%. As a peace candidate, he said he would try to implement. And, of course, at the beginning, he did. He met with Putin in December that year within the format of the Normandy 4 in France. But then, of course, even as he was meeting, it was the anti-capitulation movement within Ukraine. Those are the guys who have taken the Ukrainian state and the Ukrainian people hostage. These are many people from Galicia, the western part, but not only, of course, the militants, the so-called, what used to be known as the Azov Battalion, the militants from the Maidan, of course, who basically seized, and they've been as some sort of extra governmental power, which has acted as a veto player, and it was that veto player which the West should have negated. And this is why I fault Angela Merkel, because obviously she took the lead in the most powerful European nation, and the United States was not part of the Normandy format overseeing the implementation of Minsk II of February 2015, which put an end to the the most savage stage of the fighting. So it was, I actually personally do fault Merkel because she never managed to solve issues. She managed to push them down the road or then, as it were, take advantage of it at a certain moment. And it was just simply by default, the situation only became aggravated. And so when the explosion came, it took all the more devastating form as we see today.
Vladimir Putin has just recently given a speech at an annual foreign policy conference. What stood out to you about what he said?
This is his speech, which he gave on the 27th of October to the Valdai International Discussion Club, as always, first of all, I mean, there's many things that, first of all, in purely physical terms, all the, I don't know about the US press, but the British media there's been a lot of talk about the fact he's ill, he's terminally ill, he's weak and so on. He was in fine form. So he's 70 years old and he's still physically in good shape and just mentally in extremely good shape. I mean, just simply technically. Second, the speech rehearsed the usual litany of grievances. Oh, that's certainly how the Western media put it. It was a considered, thoughtful speech which recapitulated the fundamental Russian argument at the end of the Cold War. And the argument is one which he's been making, but one which even independent academics and scholars have been making in the West, is that we needed that a unipolar world, that a one-dimensional world, a world in which just sees the expansion of NATO, and, as I call it, of the political West, is inevitably going